This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, New Books Network audience. I am your host, Erica Monahan, and today we are having a conversation about a terrific new book called Picturing Russian Empire.
Picturing Russian Empire is a multi-essay volume
edited by three fantastic authors, editors, and we have two of those authors with us here today. The editor that cannot be with us is Sergei Kozlov. Sergei Kozlov is a senior researcher at Tumen State University in Siberia, Russia. He is a trained medievalist. But I have the pleasure of being here with his two co-editors today, and they are...
Joan Neuberger is professor emerita at the University of Texas at Austin. She is the author of several books and many more articles. Her most recent monograph was... This Thing of Darkness, Eisenstein's Ivan the Terrible in Stalin's Russia, an award-winning book published by Cornell in 2019. And her first book was Hooliganism, Crime and Culture in St. Petersburg, 1900 to 1914, published in 1993.
Her co-editor is Valerie Kibbleson. Valerie Kibbleson is Thomas N. Tentler Collegiate Professor of History and the Arthur F. Turnow Professor of History at the University of Michigan. She is the author of Cartographies of Tsardom, Desperate Magic, and Autocracy in the Provinces, as well as many other books and articles and edited volumes in between those works. I encourage you to check out both of these editors' profiles. But today, we are here to talk about their new publication, Picturing Russian Empire, published by Oxford University Press in 2023. A heavy topic at an even heavier time to talk about the history of the Russian Empire. And so I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. In New Books Network tradition, I want to start by asking both of our editors, how did you get interested in history? Tell us about your path into history, please. And maybe we'll start with Joan, and then go to Val.
Hello, Erica, and thank you for doing this interview. We're really delighted to talk about our new book. How did I get interested in history? I studied literature as an undergraduate, Russian literature and Russian language, and I was lucky enough to get to go to Leningrad, St. Petersburg, as it's called today, when I was an undergraduate. But I found that when I was there, most of the things I was interested in were historical. I had all my questions were historical questions rather than literary questions. And I really wanted to understand how this society of the late Soviet Union had come to be, and rather than sort of the ways it was represented in literature. So it was a hard choice for me, actually, to choose between literature and history, which maybe helps explain why I leaned back to representations in film and culture in my career as it developed.
Thank you. Oh, super. And Val, how about you?
Well, my past comes directly from my grandmother, my babushka, who lived through the Russian Revolution and told colorful stories that were very loosely connected to reality, in which she was really the main protagonist of the Russian Revolution, it turned out. So that was both fascinating and a clue that history was about stories and storytelling, and that propelled me down this road.
Oh gosh, that is fantastic. And I just want to say, Joan, my first trip was to the Soviet Union, and I have just been animated by this question of how did this get to be like this? That's just stayed with me and taken me farther and farther and back in time. So thank you for that, and to budding future historians out there in the audience who find themselves just niggled by the same questions. All right, now to picturing Russian Empire. For those of us in our audience that don't know, you teamed up in 2008 to produce a book picturing Russia, which I and so many historian colleagues use to great effect in our classes. And here it seems like you decided to team up and do it again. So please tell us about that, and why did you write this book or author edit this book?
Okay, so this is Joan. The main impetus for writing this book is that Val and I enjoyed picturing Russia so much, we really wanted to work together again. And we threw around a lot of different topics, but we kept coming back to picturing Russia, and we decided that we would do something on Empire. And then... we happened to be in Tumen I can't remember, Val, but it was sometime like 2015, 16, 17, something like that. And our friends in Moscow, our historian friends in Moscow, linked us to Sergei, who was then a professor, as he is still now, in the university there. And he took us all over Tumen for one thing, and we all went to Tobolsk together, which was... long dream of Val's, which meant it became a long dream of mine. And and then Sergei organized a conference for our contributors in the summer of 2019. So that was a huge further impetus to really getting this book done. And I want to add that having a conference in Tumen rather than in Moscow for an international group of contributors made a huge impact on the book and on the community of writers who contributed to this book. It's hard to really pinpoint what that means, but it definitely shaped the way that we talked to each other and came together as a community to be outside of the metropole and to be in the heart of the empire, but there are many, many different hearts of the empire. So I would say that's how we got. That's the beginning process. Then we invited many, many more, or we invited other contributors to fill in some blanks in the table of contents. And then, of course, when Oxford agreed to publish the book, the editors had their own ideas about ways in which we would structure the book. And they had us write, which we didn't do for the first book. They had us write introductions to each chronological chapter, and they generously allowed us to create our own maps. I'll stop there. I don't know, Val, if you want to add to that.
Dad, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I just wanted to call out Sergei again, that Joan and I really wanted to do another project together. And when we met Sergei, we realized, well, this is going to be a great team. And we really worked out the shaping of it as a threesome.
Super. And if I could also chime in here, I am a contributor to the volume. I expected it to be terrific. And the finished product, when it got into my hands, even blew me away farther. I mean, it's just beautiful. It's so well done. I really encourage our listeners to get your hands on it and flip through it in its entirety. I mean, it's just so rich and colorful and beautiful. And if I may also make one more comment about to kind of building on what both of you said about history being stories and the maybe feel of having been in that conference, we participated in that conference, and we went on an excursion in to the new museum to the Romanov dynasty and their exile and ultimate execution. And this museum in Tobolsk was newly opened. And I remember walking through it because I did much of my research in Tobolsk, and that museum wasn't there then, just realizing how this sort of a museum, nostalgic, sentimental towards the royal family, didn't exist in the Soviet Union. And that now we were in this space that was completely kind of celebratory of the dynasty, and it seemed to hearken that change. To the book, I'm going to start with a question or a couple of questions bundle that are probably immediately on the minds of our listeners, given the title of the book. Did Putin's escalation of the war with the full-scale invasion in February 2022 alter your vision of the volume? And if so, how? And here, the more specific question that I'll tack into this is speaks to some of the essays. The volume ends with a photo essay by Joan, where you called Experiencing Wartime. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm presuming that this experience of writing about something that is in the moment going on, unfinished, was unlike anything you've done before. You're a historian. We're still in the middle of this. And so I'm interested in hearing a little bit more from you specifically, Joan, about that experience of writing and how you approached it. But maybe Val, you could start with that. How did the full-scale invasion change your view of the volume, if at all?
Yeah, of course, it changed it profoundly. So I think in our academic world, Empire's star has been rising for a couple of decades, that after being a terrible thing and a slur that you could throw at a aggrandizing power, it became a new way of pushing back intellectually against the frame of the nation state. And so a lot of scholars have been thinking about empire as a more kind of capacious political formation that could contain a lot of difference. So empires of difference have become a kind of catchphrase. And I think that framing really shaped some of the vision of the initial vision of the book, that sure, empire was an oppressive state formation, but it allowed for so much variety, and the visual allowed for almost a celebration of that visual production took on so many different forms, and so many of them were beautiful. And there was a more delightful tone to the volume before the invasion, which reminded us, oh, right, empire really is an aggrandizing and violent formation. And that profoundly changed both the way we approach the introductions and the ways our authors approach their work. So we were fortunate in the timing, in this unfortunate way, that our authors did have time to go back and at least tweak their essays as appropriate. And a number of them show that that change in just fundamental conception. And of course, Joan's essay does that most of all. But before turning over to Joan, I also want to say we have many Russian contributors, and this, of course, has cast a bit of a pall and a complication. And we really value having those contributors who stuck with it.
Thank you. Joan, Maybe speak about your experience writing the final essay.
Well, you're right, Erica. It's very different from what I normally write. And it was actually very difficult to write. So let me start by saying that that Empire is not really my field. And so I was just contributing to the introduction and the introductions. I didn't have an essay in the book. And then Oxford wanted us to write something about the war, and they wanted us to write a photo essay. So I volunteered to do that, in part because I'd been collecting visual images of the war from the very beginning, and I was very interested in the sort of artistic response and the response of art historians in Ukraine to the full-scale invasion. So I had a lot of material, and I knew that I'd been shaped, that my view of what was going on there was shaped very profoundly by the images that I was looking at. But I found it incredibly difficult to write, and it took me a long time even just to get started. At the very beginning, sometime in early March, I'd written an article about Ukrainian poetry because I was finding that poetry was the only language I could understand at that time, that the historians' and analytical language was not helping me understand what was going on there. So anyway, eventually I sat down and took all this material and put it together. And it ended up being a really nice coda to the book in the sense that one of the main questions that we ask throughout the book is, how do images work? Do images have agency? What kind of agency do images have? How are they constructed in a moment? And how do they reflect their small moment, their small historical place and time and individual or collective producers, but also how do they show awareness of a larger multinational, international, multimedia context? So those are the questions that I tried to answer in the essay. I think I have to say that I was so impressed especially by Ukrainian art historians and artists who were asking much more profound questions, many of them in Ukraine at the time, many of them in exile at the time. These questions also, to what extent do images, to what extent are images themselves violent? What kind of violence do they contain, or how do they contain what violence is being enacted at the time? These questions really helped me hone in on the essay that I wanted to write.
Thank you. And those questions are not limited to this particular sphere of Russian Empire as well. So, which is one of the things of value I think I find in this inquiry that you all have constructed and present to us all here. I kind of want to stay with this, the problems of history and the present. And one of those problematic components is the history of medieval Rus and its foundings. Putin's claims to the Russian nation having its history in what is Ukrainian territory. And so you write in your introduction, and quoting, "Selective, exaggerated, or patently false reimaginings of that medieval past have been central to Russia's justification of its claims on its neighbor to the southwest," end quote. So you're very, very well aware of that. And yet there are people who would say the rest of the world has been complicit in Russia's claims to empire, and one of the ways it had done that is by going along with beginning Russian history in Kiev and Rus. So, and you both know the problems with it and know the history well. And so I want to ask you, for people who might object to this formulation of even putting these periods in this volume together, how do you respond? Maybe Val, since you're our medievalist, maybe I'll go to you.
Yeah. Of course, this is a painful question, and has been for medievalists for a while, but but now it's impossible to ignore, of course. So one of the beauties, I think, of the long time frame that we cover in this book is that we cover, we start in the ninth century. So long before there's anything called Russia, and certainly long before there is an empire, a Russian empire. But there are other empires, and the Rus occupy a place amid and amongst those empires. So Rus history, the medieval period, is born among empires. And our early essays really bring that out. Then that history is up for grabs. And the volume traces the complex uses of the history and relations of different parts of Rus in historical imagination. I just call attention to Maria Grazia Bartolini's essay in the book, which talks about the way Ukrainian churchmen in the 16th and mostly 17th centuries played on the medieval relationship between Southern Rus and Northern Rus in order to carve out a particular, in some ways, protected place in the now Russian Empire. So this has been a question that's been at play from the very beginning. And the volume, I think, does a good job of keeping those questions alive and exploring them along the way.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, and I would say, as someone, I began my graduate training in the post-Soviet, the first post-Soviet decade. And this is, from day one, has always been a very, very important issue. But there's a certain modernist myopia that I think has kind of prevails a little bit in many academic places in the world. And so for those more modernist focusing places, I think it has hit harder, these questions. But so thank you so much for that. Go ahead.
Could I just jump in on that? I think the modernism in some ways is really helpful and productive here. So right now I'm teaching a medieval Rus, early modern course. And we started on the first day asking, does medieval Rus belong in a class on Russian history? And so it gives us an ability to put that question, which students used to be kind of indifferent to, front and center. And now the salience of it is so clear that the stakes of historical narrative become evident.
Thank you. Actually, staying with that kind of interplay between deep past and present, two essays dealing with very different chronologies in the book deal with Svyatoslav, the last pagan ruler of Rus. One comes early in the volume and written by one of the editors, Sergei Kozlov, and the other comes near the end of the volume in the last section, the most contemporary history by Yulia Mikhailova, trained as a medievalist herself. Please tell us about these two essays and Svyatoslav, and what is he doing at both ends of this volume? What do these articles reveal about the themes?
Okay, well, that's a tough one. And I think Svyatoslav himself is a figure who attracts mythologizing. He's mythologized already in The Tale of Bygone Years, the medieval chronicle, where he becomes the sort of epitome of manly warrior intrepidness. And it is interesting because he's the last pagan ruler commemorated by Christian chroniclers, and yet he's definitely a glamorous figure. Sergei's essay shows that he also attracts myth-making from all of his neighbors, including his foes. He shows up in all those empires that the Rus were among in visual depictions, in chronicle depictions. And then those in turn spawn the myth-making that you're referring to, that Yulia Mikhailova talks about, where he becomes a kind of split, a figure of that's embraced by Cossack identity and contested then in the politics, Ukrainian-Russian politics today. So I guess it's another way of seeing the power of historical narrative and the way certain narratives lend themselves to political and identity-based claims.
So can I jump in here then and say that these two articles at either end of the book also are good examples of the two major concepts that we think come out of this book and sort of ended up being our organizing principle when we were writing our introduction, for example. First of all, the pictosphere, which is a concept that we adapted from Simon Franklin's brilliant work on the graphosphere, as a concept that shows the ways that the visual creates networks of meaning through all of its material and suggested and fictional and other attributes. Belle's better at talking about this than I am. And the other one is a midness, which we recognize is not a very elegant term. We spent many hours trying to come up with a better word for a midness, but it really captures the ways in which it seemed to us that the producers of visual images were aware of much more than kind of binary imperial relationships or binary East-West relationships, but really seemed to be aware of the multiple of being amid multiple different cultures, of being part often our producers are themselves ethnically hybrid. More than hybrid, but ethnically themselves descendants of multiple ethnicities. And we just found this very rich awareness of something that helped us break down some of the binaries in Russian history, in Russian historiography, or in the historiography of empire.
Thank you so much. Yes, you actually, I was going to very much ask you about that question of this idea of a midness. And I would say I appreciate it very much because as someone, I mean, as we all know that from the 19th century and some would even trace it earlier, this question of much earlier, you know, Peter talked about it, Catherine the Second talked about it, is Russia of the East or of the West? That's one of those major binaries we just can't escape. And then Eurasianism can often be quite unsatisfying as well. And so I appreciate that this notion, however inelegant you might find it, a midness. It's so many different levels, hierarchies, genealogies, geographies. So thank you for this idea of a midness. And also,
I'd just like to call out Monica White's essay, the very first essay in the book, which I just want to say I think does an amazing job, together with Irina Konovalova's essay, the second essay in the book, of introducing so many of the concepts that are going to be important throughout the book, and also of introducing medieval Rus in a way that is all the complex issues are sort of made lucid. Her article is about coinage made by Vladimir, known in by different names in our different cultures, which the imagery of which were drawn from the empires surrounding Rus, which itself was barely a state and definitely not an empire at that time. And he seemed to be drawing, and Monica argues that he seemed to be drawing on this imagery in order to establish the legitimacy and importance and connectedness of Rus with the world around it. That's just a great example of what we're talking about.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I agree. It is a lovely essay. And actually, if I can, for this idea of the pictosphere, drawing from Simon Franklin's book, The Graphosphere, listeners interested in hearing a bit more about the graphosphere can listen to a History Exilo conversation I had with Simon Franklin about that book. So thanks for bringing that up. Okay, back to picturing Russian empire. And there's 56 articles in the book. As I said, it's so rich. There's so much, and we won't be able to get to all of it, but I want to ask questions that give you the opportunity to talk about various ones, even though we can't get to all of them, unfortunately. But I want to start by asking a question about Orientalism. I'm so struck by the representations of Central Asia in the volume. And I wanted to ask you about how this body of evidence reinforces or alters our ideas about Orientalism in the Russian Empire. Russia occupied this particular space on the civilizational spectrum, and many are already aware probably of how Dostoevsky in the 1870s famously declared, in Europe, we were hangers-on and slaves, but in Asia, we are masters. And you write in the introduction that these essays, quote, offer a way to break through the encrusted binaries of the ongoing debate over Russian Orientalism. And so could you explain what you mean by that and say more about that, please, Joan?
Sure. Let me talk about Orientalism, because you quoted the main argument that we make in the book, and that I think the essays bring out, that that the essays themselves help us understand Orientalism in Russian history by breaking down those binaries, and by breaking down some of the concepts that were central to Edward Said's original concept of Orientalism as a construction of Western scholars looking at the Middle East and seeing it as timeless and exotic and sort of making up what it was. Maria Tarutina's article is a great example of the way a midness help is at the heart of breaking down these binaries. And her article is about illustrations of Lermontov's Demon, which is set in the Caucasus, made by artists at the artist colony outside of Moscow in Abramtseva, including the work of Mikhail Vrubel, who is sort of the center of this essay. And she shows that that if we look at all of these images as a group, there are no stable stereotypes of the Caucasus, and that all the stereotypes are continually being contested and reinvented, and they're still stereotypes. The empire is still in play, but they're not stable. They're not widely shared, so they're constantly being broken down and reinvented. And then Vrubel comes along and tries to make images that are not stereotypical, but rather realistic, which is kind of weird for Vrubel, but that's what he was doing. He tried to represent the demon and all the characters as realistic people from Georgia. And he got attacked for this by critics and fellow artists who saw these as not fitting into their own idea of what the stereotypes should be. So in other words, there's no sort of, this is an example of how in the Russian Empire, Orientalism breaks down and shows us the variety of ways in which people from the center or from any of the Russian centers are looking at the people of empire in a variety of ways. And then Helena Holzberger's article on photography of Central Asia in the 1930s is another example of how Orientalism works in different ways. She shows, so Central Asia became a major subject for photographers in the 1930s. All the great photographers basically had to go to Central Asia to do a photo series. And they had strict instructions from the center that they were to show various ways in which Central Asia was modernizing or becoming Soviet. And those two concepts overlap uneasily as well. And she shows that while they did use some sort of stereotypical images of Central Asia, photos of camels, photos of people on horseback, photos of sort of traditional occupations like spinning and weaving, they always seem to question basic concepts of that we associate with Orientalism. So the sort of propaganda instruction of modernization challenges the whole notion of timelessness of the place, right? And then by using avant-garde visual techniques of canted angles and lighting and so, and you know, off-center lighting and so on, that she shows. So for example, she has a photograph of a camel caravan, but it's shown from a very low angle, cameras at a very low angle. It kind of questions both the timelessness of the caravan as well as the sort of modernistic, modernizing narrative, as well as really anything. It just makes you, as modernists wanted to do, it makes you look at these things anew. So, and then the photographers, many of the photographers themselves were of hybrid identities, Russian and Jewish, Russian and Central Asian, Jewish and Central Asian. And so it's hard to say what the point of view, what the sort of ethnic or Russian point of view on these topics was. And I think those are two essays that make us rethink Russian Orientalism and sort of the way in which we think of it is like a horizontal line between Europe, Russia in the middle, and the East on the other end, and complicate all of those issues.
Thank you. Flipping through the volume, and there you feature so many different types of images, you know, not just paintings, but newspapers and postcards and coins and high elite production and non-elite production. And there's just so much visual material in the pictosphere. I mean, that the volume brings that impression up in such a tangible way that I think it's worth pausing on. But even as I flip through this, all of this visual material in the pictosphere that sends messages about empire and whether, you know, all of these contributors are just such amazing analysts with this point of view that you really do come away. These images are about empire, both real and aspirational, intended, unintended, that it left me wondering, you know, was there a centralized, institutionalized approach to visually representing the empire? And if not, then how do you account for it, if not this saturation, this widespread, sustained presence of material that intentionally or not, in some measure, comments on, reflects an imperial dynamic, presence, et cetera?
Now, how about that? Yeah, we both really appreciate this question because I think it's a way to get at the heart of what the volume does, which is to show how pervasive the empire was and how much room there was for local expression, individual expression. So, of course, there are imbalances in survival of sources, especially early on, that state-generated sources, state-preserved sources are going to last longer through history. And there are imbalances of what's allowable. So if things are censored, they're harder to get to. So the state, the imperial institution, is going to weigh in seen and unseen ways on the material that our authors have to deal with. And another sort of distortion is built in by our call for papers, which asks people to interrogate the intersection between images and empire. But that said, it reflects something real about imperial experience. Huge proportions of the population were involved in state service in one way or another, whether as state employed coachmen and postmen or state serfs or whatever they were. The state really did have tentacles everywhere. So that's another hybrid identity, is an artist producing work as an employee of an Academy of Sciences ethnographic expedition, or as an ethnographer artist who's interested in documenting the people of the Volga, both. And the pictosphere, again, we think is a really useful concept because it allows us to think of this entire imperial space as one that is producing images with local pooling and individual motivations and hybrid perspectives that show us how empires actually work and actually are experienced.
Yeah, can I give some examples? I was thinking, Val, when you were talking about how so many people worked for the empire or worked in ways that were connected to the empire. Anna Graeber's article about the mining region and portraits of a mine owner's children. These were made to appeal to the government to promote the child, the son, basically a portrait of him was made to present to the state to get him a promotion in rank. And then in a more modern period, there are some essays that are just pure state propaganda. So Yana Skarbogatov's article about a documentary made about Sakhalin is basically just a lesson in imperialism, in the sense that Sakhalin is presented as open and welcoming for Russian settlers, both in presenting familiarity, scenes of that would be familiar to Russians and make it look welcoming from that point of view, and then presenting the indigenous people as so thrilled with the presence of Russian technology that it presented them as welcoming Russian settlers with open arms. But then we have an example that I think complicates that in Molly Arbuthnot's article about state propaganda in the 1920s. Posters that were presented to a Muslim population. And of course, Soviet posters, Russian posters, Russian language posters for the Russian population are famous for their avant-garde styles and artists who made them. And, you know, they're presented all over the world as being a great Soviet example. But when they made posters for their Muslim and Arabic-speaking and Turkic-speaking populations, they used images from those cultures, from Central Asian cultures, as the the sort of subject of the propaganda and as the basis of their style. So these were ways that the state sort of opened up. You could look at it two ways, right? It's the ways that the state exploited or state artists exploited local cultures for their purposes. But it's also an opening to creating more diverse and mixed visual images by local artists, right? So it said these images and these styles and these traditions are legitimate forms of representation.
Thank you so much. And the Skarabagatev article that has all these stills from films, and you know, I'm not a film studies specialist, so I really appreciated the articles and the ones through the Pamirs as well that kind of break down what's going on in when we pause and look closely at these images that would otherwise just watch through us. So those are some, I really enjoyed those contributions as well. I'd like to go back to some questions that you raised both in the introduction, and I've heard you hear Joan earlier pointed to some of these driving questions. So one that I want to ask you, do images have, or to what extent do images work as active agents affecting change and determining viewer response? Or Joan, but maybe Val, you'll take that first, or?
So that's a great question, and it is a driving question of the volume. At some level, I think it's obvious that images work. At least regimes certainly think so, because they put a lot of work into presenting their propaganda in visual terms. Advertisers think it works. And so there's a lot there are a lot of studies that show that barraging people with imagery works. So at one level, the answer is obvious. At another level, how do these, especially minor genres, work in the world? It's very hard to get viewer response in most of these situations. But something like the Sviatoslav pairing that you gave us suggests that images have afterlives. And that in itself, I think, testifies to the power of those images to persist and be deployed and adapted as time goes on to different causes, different uses. I guess I'm thinking now about maybe Bart Pushaw's essay in the book, which talks about photographs of Estonian types, which were deployed in the late 19th century, both as part of an imperial ethnographic impulse to collect and document the peoples of empire, but also to create and broadcast an image of an Estonian nation from an Estonian point of view. Or maybe my essay, which is on the racialization of Tatars in Muscovite imagery over the course of the 16th and 17th centuries. In the 16th century, Tatars appear exactly the same as Russians in illustrations. In the 17th century, they start to acquire demonic traits, not exactly human racial traits, but those of demons, which both reflect and harden views of Tatars as other or lesser or scary in the Russian imagination. So I think Those are both good examples of images that do work in the world.
Super. Thanks. And in some ways, maybe it's related. But this is a question you ask in the introduction, so I'm going to ask it here as well. And that's about what agency images have in producing or resisting empire. What does this volume have to say about that? You've kind of covered on the producing part. I think you've talked about that a bit, and less so far on the resisting empire end of things. So what role do images have in resisting empire?
I think one form of resistance, I mean, it might be considered a sort of form of passive resistance, but one form of resistance is the maintenance of local culture against this sort of juggernaut coming from the center. So we have Alessia Vovina's article about embroidery, Chuvash embroidery, this community on the Volga. And we see the ways that they continually reproduce traditional forms of embroidery, even as they become implicated in government projects. There's just a real sense that maintaining their own culture within a larger, sometimes, you know, attempt to sort of exploit local culture for state propaganda ends.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add to that. Another good example of that is Angelina Lucento's article on the Tatar avant-garde. Overtly anti-imperial are some of the modern pieces, Jones, of course, but also Josh First, that talks about Ukrainian film that just ignores Russia and the empire, just removes it. And Karen Petrone's about the dismantling of Soviet war monuments. So I think that part is built in as well.
Yeah, there's a good deal of material to give us some perspective on that as well. I know your time is short today. I want to wrap up. So my final question to you about the volume is about chronology. Are there generalizations you'd make about imagery across the imperial-Soviet divide? It seems like we, Russian East Europeanists are always aware of that binary divide.
Sure. I would say that the sort of concepts that we found sort of arose from the articles of the Pictosphere and Amidness is probably the closest we would come to thinking about or identifying a generalization about the role of images in the Russian Empire. So Pictosphere being a dynamic and constantly constant interpolation and dialogue and dissemination of images in networks across the empires. One of the things that we see throughout this period, and then amidness, you know, the sense, I just really want to push back against all the binaries that exist and say that even in terms of the, I think we wrote in the introduction that a common metaphor for empires is kind of wheel with center and spokes, that even that we want to push back against in the sense that creates a binary between center and periphery, and just show what really impressed me was the ways in which production inside, but especially outside of Moscow, really, and St. Petersburg outside the Russian capitals, really seemed to be working in a much more complex and complex in every, I mean, I wish I had a better word than complex, but in a way that was multidimensional and multidirectional and aware that empire is not just a relationship between peoples and the center, but among peoples among peoples and cultures throughout the empire, if that makes sense. I'd like people to have a picture of an image of the Russian Empire as something that almost as Josh Versch talks about in those Maidan films, that maybe ignores Russia to a certain extent, or ignores, you know, Central Russia, ethnic Russia, and understands that there was communication and awareness of this incredibly diverse space.
Thank you so much. Val, as a final word, is there anything to that you'd like to add?
I guess I would just second what Joan said. I think that chronological question wasn't one of the driving questions. It really was to complicate the idea of empire. And here, just to pull out an example again, Willard Sunderland's article on Father Hyacinth, who's the Russian sinologist, who actually isn't Russian at all. He was Chuvash, I believe, complicating the binaries once again.
Thank you so much. I want to say thank you to our listeners for listening. On behalf of many in the field, thank you for doing this work. I know even for me, you really pushed me to see images and think more deeply about them. And I'm grateful for that opportunity. And I'm so grateful to both of you for joining us in this conversation today. So thank you very, very much. And goodbye.
Thank you.